Our guest speaker today is actually two people. Jim Lovell is the astronaut who commanded the ill-fated yet heroic mission to the moon in 1970. Tom Hanks is the actor who plays Jim Lovell in this summer's smash hit movie, Apollo 13. As the film's narration points out, Apollo 13 was the most successful failure in the history of manned space flight. The explosion of an onboard oxygen tent prevented the mission from achieving its objective, a landing on the moon. However, with the help of the NASA team, Mr. Lovell and two fellow astronauts overcame incredible odds to manage a safe return to Earth. For 5 days, life on Earth came to a virtual standstill as television networks that had offered a collective yawn at the launch of Apollo 13 then began to preempt regular programming to report on how the troubled mission was faring. While Mr. Lovell will be best remembered for his Apollo 13 adventure, he actually completed 4 missions into space in all, 2 with the Gemini program and 2 with Apollo. His early missions helped develop the docking techniques that would be crucial in the eventual landing on the moon. It is my pleasure to inform you all today that the White House is announcing this afternoon that President Clinton is awarding the 9th Congressional Space Medal of Honor to James A. Lovell. For his, and I quote, contributions to the welfare of the nation and to all humanity, unquote. I'll read a portion of the citation, quote, as one of our early pioneers in space, Mr. Lovell piloted both the Gemini 7 and the Gemini 12 missions. Gemini 7 included the first rendezvous of 2 human-controlled maneuverable spacecraft. Mr. Lovell served as command module pilot on Apollo 8, humankind's maiden voyage to the moon, and the crew became the first humans to leave the Earth's gravitational influence. Apollo 13, launched in 1970, proved the program's ability to weather a major crisis and bring the crew back home safely, end of quote from the citation. For all his exploits in outer space, however, one of Mr. Lovell's most important decisions was made right here on Earth. After Hollywood bought the rights to his story, he was asked, who do you think should play you in the movie? Without hesitation, Mr. Lovell replied, Kevin Costner. Mr. Costner wasn't available, so Hollywood had to turn to a second choice, an obscure actor. Sorry, I told you. An obscure actor named Tom Hanks. Tom who? Tom Hanks. Seriously, though, after his stellar performances in the movies Philadelphia and Forrest Gump, Mr. Hanks now stands a good chance of becoming the first person ever to win 3 Best Actor Oscars in a row for his impersonation of Kevin Costner playing Jan Lovell. If Mr. Hanks wasn't the first name to come to Mr. Lovell's mind, the actor quickly won the astronaut over with his enthusiasm for the role. Mr. Hanks long has harbored a fascination with outer space and astronauts. When he first met Jim Lovell, it was Tom Hanks who was asking for autographs. Today, our two guests will share their thoughts on the Apollo 13 mission, in reality and in the movies, and on the future of space exploration. Now, before we begin, I ask the photographers, please stay back, because we don't have that much time left. First, warm welcome for Mr. Tom Hanks, who will make some remarks and then introduce Jim Lovell. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Boy, it's never too late to get back on that old celebrity mule train and just push a movie, you know? 4 weeks after release, you can always work in another press stop. No problem. You know, if Kevin Costner had played Jim Lovell, which it still would have been a wonderful movie, because I still would have been in it. I would have done whatever was necessary to play Fred Hayes, and I would have done a fine job in that role as well. I would have played him as a quiet astronaut, though, Jim. Not quite what Bill Paxton did. Now, because I was so inspired by the space program as a young man, because I was of that age where the space program was held up as the perfect example of everything America was supposed to be, as well as a great lesson for any child to pay attention to in school. It was part physics, it was part government, it was part science, but it was also part art and inspiration, just by the very fact that we were deciding to hurl men into the unforgiving vacuum and yet at the same time glorious free fall of outer space. I have always harbored a great fascination for the space program, and I was up on all of the Apollo program. I knew the crews, I knew the flights, and I knew the mission goals as they were stated, and I was in fact very much involved in the drama that went on with Apollo 13. I woke up in the morning and read the headline in the San Francisco Chronicle on the 14th of April in 1970 and saw that the mission was in danger. I ran home from Bret Hart Junior High School in Oakland, California to watch Jules Bergman on TV. Jules Bergman was my science editor of choice as a 13-year-old. I watched ABC and Jules Bergman tell me about the status of the mission. Not long after that, I guess I became 14 years old and gave up the space program for the things that suddenly attract the attention of your average 14-year-old. None of which I'm ashamed of, I'm happy to say. Years go by, and as I became an actor, I had just played the baseball player in the motion picture League of Their Own, which has gone down in history as being known as that Madonna film. And after having had that opportunity, I was sitting around with my crack team of show business experts, the two old ladies who work for me part-time, and they asked me, well, Tom, what do you want to do? What do you want to do next? I mean, if you could do anything, what would you want to do? Now, I have to confess that most American actors have what we know as the Big Four. We have four different roles that we want to play. We want to do any sort of a movie that allows us to be a cowboy, an army man, a baseball player, and, in fact, an astronaut. I had played the baseball player, so I was searching around for one of the remaining three items on the Big Four to do. And I pointed out to them that that the story of Apollo 13, I thought then, years ago, would make a fascinating story because I was aware of it. My crack team of show business experts says, was that the one that landed on the moon? And I said, no, that I explained what the story was to them. And we then promptly decided to wait 3 years for Jeff and Jim to get together and write the book that we could base the movie on. From a pure movie-making point of view, from a pure storytelling point of view, the great thing about the saga of Apollo 13 is that there is nothing that we could have made up that would have been better than what Jim and Fred and Jack and the people in Mission Control actually went through. It was, as those of you who have seen it, even though you know that Jim is here, and so the movie does have a happy ending, a very happy ending, I might say. As a matter of fact, with this space mental, there's a sequel in it now that we can put together, the continuing saga, and I don't think Kevin's available to play Jim in the sequel, so I still have a chance. Because of the actual facts, literally the historical record, we had a story that was unbelievably fascinating and, oddly enough, brand new. A joke that we had when we were making the movie was, you know, we're telling a story about people going to the moon. We're making a movie about a voyage around the moon, and it is a period piece. We're driving old cars that have horrible emission controls on them. We're wearing fabrics that are not found anywhere in nature. Kathleen Quinlan as Marilyn Lovell had shades of color on her face that have never been duplicated again. As well as hair, and oh, it was wild. But that's the great storytelling aspect of Apollo 13. The greater artistic aspect of Apollo 13, the story, the movie, I think, is the presence of Mr. Jim Lovell. The irony of a man who, even when I was 13 years old and knew that Jim had been around the moon once already, to me was what set it apart from any other sort of movie of its ilk, any other sort of adventure story, and made it something that would land in the lap, I think, of every American, any human being that is seeing the movie for the first time. Knowing that Jim has been around the moon, knowing that Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes and Jack Swaggart are circling the moon on just one great big arc of trajectory to hurl back to Earth like some sort of thrown hammer, I think is what makes it something that is oddly approachable, not just to us as human beings, but also to us as people who understand the concepts of art. It's a story that's told right out of the Greeks. It's equal to Ulysses on his own individual odyssey, coming back around and wondering just purely whether or not we will get home. I think I have been I've been a very lucky man because I've been able to benefit from being an actor and being able to tell the story, to be able to take part in, I love my job. I'll make movies about anything. It's the greatest job in the world. It's way better than what you people do for a living. I get to dress up and pretend to be somebody else and pretend to do great things. I really feel that I'm very, very fortunate, and I think all of us on the film, Bill Paxton and Kevin Bacon and Ed Harris, all the actors who were involved in the movie, Gary Sinise, we all felt that it was an honor to be playing these men and women. We felt it was a great privilege to be able to be paid to do something, to tell a story that we think is so inspiring and so hopeful and part of our collective consciousness as Americans. And I think, was the luckiest of them all because I got to play this guy who, for 2 weeks on the flight of Gemini 7, sat right next to Frank Borman with tubes sticking out of his head and things wrapped around his legs. I can only imagine that must have smelled pretty bad in that little Gemini capsule by the time it was done. I got to play a man who sat in the left-hand seat on Gemini 12, and while Buzz Aldrin was off making a flawless EVA in outer space, was able to tell him to check under the hood and wash the windows while he was out there. I got to play one of the first three men who left the Earth's planet gravitational field, visited and orbited the moon, literally the first three human beings to go, literally where no man has gone before. And I got to play the commander, the guy in the left-hand seat, the man who is going to receive the space Congressional Space Medal of Honor. I got to play Mr. Jim Lovell. Jim?
Boy. I don't know. Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Tom is a hard act to follow. Let me put it that way. I recall I was being with Ron Howard one time, and Tom gave one of those nice talks, And Ron said, boy, that guy can really talk. And Tom, any time that you want to get out of the acting business and want to be my press agent, be my guest. let me begin my remarks by somehow telling you exactly how this whole project got started. Naturally, 25 years ago, this incident occurred. When we got off the spacecraft, got on the carrier, and Jack and Fred and I looked at each other, we dusted ourselves off, and we found out we were still alive. We said, you know, this would make a very good story. Why don't we write a book about it? And we all vowed that we'd get together and write a book. But you know the best intentions of everybody. Jack eventually went into politics. Fred went into the aerospace industry. I got involved in telephones. And it wasn't until 1991 when I retired and my secretary looked at me. I still had an office for a little bit. She said, what are you going to do? And then she said, why don't you write that book you've been telling me about all these years? And so I said, fine. But I said, I'm not a career author. And 91 went by, but then 92, I got a letter out of the blue from a young man by the name of Jeffrey Kluger. He said, I'm a writer for the Discover magazine, written a lot of articles, never wrote a full-length book before, thought that Apollo 13 would be a good story. And I wrote back, I said, yeah, I'd like to do the same thing. Let's co-author this thing. And so we did. We got started, had an agent. We produced a little outline, one chapter, and an outline out of that. Our agent sent it around. We got a publisher. Boy, I'm happy as a clam. Now we got to start working on this book. Unbeknownst to us, a couple of months later, our agent sent it out to California. It was passed around to various movie production companies. Ron Howard happened to see it and liked it. And I got a call from the agent. I was sitting down. He said, are you sitting down? And I said, uh-oh, the publisher is reneging. There must be something in the back of the contract. And he says, we just sold an option to the movie industry. I said, you got to be kidding. We haven't written the book yet. Well, to make a long story short, you know, the option was there. We went out to talk to Ron. And I apologize, Tom. I really made a mistake when I thought that Kevin Costner could do the job, because there is a closet astronaut right there. And, of course, when Tom came aboard the project, that's when the option turned into the real thing. Now, why is this movie so successful? Is it because of Ron Howard's direction? Certainly he had a lot to do with it. Great director. Is it the actors that portrayed it? Well, you know, Tom, he did a magnificent job, and the other people did just as well. Is it the special effects? Yep, there's lots of special effects, state of the art. But there's a lot more to this movie than just a movie. I think it reminds the audience, when they go into this movie, of something that was real, something that was that they were proud of as Americans. The patriotic, you know, fever in their bodies that come up, and they saw something that was real life, a crisis that had been overcome due to the teamwork and the motivation of a lot of people involved. And I think that is the real reason why this movie has still been number one in the movie houses and why everybody seems to like it. It appeals to all ages. Do you remember Sputnik? A lot of you people probably weren't born at that time. 1957, I remember Sputnik. The Russians suddenly put a missile up there, or a satellite, and we were all saying to ourselves, why couldn't we do that? What's wrong with our educational system? And it turned out in that chaos that NASA was formed, and all of a sudden, for the next 30-some years, a lot of people looked up at NASA as sort of a role model. A lot of young people followed careers due to what NASA was doing in space. I can recall a lot of people coming to me in the last few years after they had made their careers and said, you know, it was your flights or so-and-so's flights that really got me to think about being a doctor or being an airline pilot or being an engineer. So I really think that role model was there. And I can recall back in 61 when President Kennedy said we're going to put a man on the moon and bring him back safely. Now, I really believe that was more political in nature than it was technical. But that brought forth a great drive of a lot of aerospace people, and by gosh, we did it with 5 months to spare. But now those days was a time where we had confrontation. We had that great evil empire out there, which was in some respects a lot of good competition. We don't have that any longer. Now it's cooperation. Now we're working together, and the Earth keeps getting smaller and smaller. And now we're into cooperation in a joint venture, an international space station. 14 countries are involved. And we have to work together. We can't really back out by ourselves anymore. It's very, very important, not just on a technical point of view, but really on a political or a diplomatic point of view. Very, very important. Then, of course, on the domestic scene, the space efforts that we have done, really what I think, is a creative program. Obviously, you all heard about spin-offs. There's a book about that thick on them. I don't have to mention that. The computer industry in the early 60s and 70s was really had a lot of start from the seed money that NASA put into it. But it's built up, and this domestic program, I think, is very, very important because it creates new industries, industries that have nothing to do with going into space, new jobs, and, of course, new taxes. So there is a return on what we do in space. But NASA itself and the space efforts that we do is not an end in itself. It's a support function. It supports other people, other industries, other government organizations with data and materials all sorts of things. For instance, in space itself, we have a microgravity environment. No convection, no gravity. We can look at a lot of things that can be done in space, new serums, new crystals for electronics industry. We have a vacuum that we can use, a pure vacuum if we have to. We have the unfiltered solar rays that can be utilized. There's lots of things we can do, and a temperature spectrum of over 400 degrees. And of course, in space, we can support not only the government operations, but the private sector. Recovering satellites, launching satellites, repairing satellites, and then, of course, looking back at the Earth. Getting that quicker return on our investment by finding out more about the Earth. All those things that affect the Earth today, all the things that we're worried about, volcanism, earthquakes, the El Nino, pollution, all those sort of things. So, why is this movie so important? It's because it brings back to the American public, all those who see it, all those who read about it, a very important part of our history, of how we faced a crisis and how we got over that crisis with teamwork and motivation and initiative. Thank you.
All right, I'm the mail sorter up here. Jim Lovell, how do you respond to critics who say that our space program now is just becoming a scholarship fund for the Russian program?
Well, let me put it this way. I think that the idea of cooperation with Russia, with the other countries, is very important. They have a lot of good technical capability over there. They don't have any money, but a lot of technical capability. That technical capability and working together can come in this direction or it can go someplace else. I would rather have us working together in a cooperation together because there's a lot of potential in Russia. And I don't think that is a waste of money or just a scholarship program.
For Tom Hanks, you've played some memorable roles in your career. Do you ever find that reality and Hollywood tend to blur together? And will the real Tom Hanks please stand up?
Well, man, I don't know, I'll make my living there. I'm probably the last guy to ask this question. I have played some very nice parts. I think that the only time that motion pictures can be a true motor for social change is when they somehow record the truth, when they're honest about what's going on in our lives. I think that for the vast in the vast overall picture, movies are a distraction from our daily lives. That's one of the reasons that we seek them out. You can call it entertainment if you want to, but the idea of going into a room for 2 hours means that you get to escape whatever it is you're experiencing on the outside world. That's not a bad thing, but that's not what the true power of motion pictures or any art really is. The true power is when you walk into a darkened theater and up on the screen you actually see your own life reflected back at you. Then it can actually be some sort of instigator for ourselves, where we not only want to emulate what we see up on the screen, but we realize that we can implement it in our own daily lives. I like to think that that's some of the things that I try to shoot for in motion pictures, but then I go off and make movies like Turner and Hooch, and I wonder what the hell I'm thinking.
For Mr. Lovell, what should NASA look like in 20 years? Should we foot the bill of $500 billion or so to send astronauts to Mars? Should we go back to the moon? Or conversely, should we rely more on robotic missions and develop less expensive goals?
Monroe, that's an age-old question. We have to balance what we do in space. We have to look at what NASA does as a support function for other entities that will help this country. A robotic exploration is cheaper and is very, very important, and NASA has not abandoned that area. They have not abandoned the research in aeronautics, which, of course, was the original NACA. I think in the future what we're going to see is really a concentration on the space station, looking back at the Earth, as I mentioned before, getting together as a cooperative effort between countries so that we can have a lot of communication between countries that spill over into other diplomatic means. I think we should keep the program going. There's no reason to drastically cut it. I can see where there could be some infrastructure changes so that it becomes more efficient. Every program, every agency that grows up becomes inefficient, and every once in a while you have to cut it down. And I'm sure you've seen this in Washington in spades. But I think that NASA could do the same thing. But the basic programs, the programs that make this country a leader, we should continue to fund in a very progressive way, not to go overboard in any one area. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Hanks, what was the most difficult aspect of Mr. Lovell's character for you to portray?
Well, of course, I was severely hampered by the fact that I looked nothing like Kevin Costner. I had breakfast with Jeff in New York City, and he was showing me stacks and stacks of photographs of Jim, and I hadn't really seen a real clear photograph. I said, oh my God, he looks just like Kevin Costner. Crying out loud. I think it actually was, you could say, the most difficult. It wasn't difficult. It was a joy every step of the way. When I was doing the, research you can, and when you're a big honking movie star and you're down in NASA talking to people about what it was like back then, and and you're done signing all the autographs and getting your picture taken, and you can actually get down to brass tacks. I asked them, what can you tell me about Jim Lovell? And they all said, Jim was just the greatest guy. Jim, and if you read like Michael Collins' books or Buzz Aldrin's books, or you need any sort of record of the space agency, you'll find out that Jim was a great pilot, an incredibly fierce competitor, but also a guy that just seemed trouble rolled right off his back, and he seemed to be able to love truly what he was doing. When I heard that, I said, well, you know what? I'm the perfect guy to play Jim.
For Mr. Lovell. In the movie, the crew was greatly relieved to learn that Ken Mattingly was working on the fuel problem in the simulator. But in the book, the problem seems to have been solved by John Aaron and Arnie Aldrich. What's the story?
You know, I always get these serious questions. Tom gets all the, you know, the soft shoe stuff. I'm going to be an actor, Tom. That's what I'm going to do, yeah. Well, seriously, you know, when you When you have a book, you have the ability to expand out and really do things in detail because the reader can take his time going through it. When you're making a movie, and the first rough cut from what Ron Howard was telling me, that after he threw away all the film he didn't really want and kept it all, it was about a four-hour movie. And consequently, Universal said, there's no way we're going to have a four-hour movie or even a three-hour movie, and they had to keep cutting it down. There are some things that had to be concentrated in the film that actually did not occur in, or did occur in more expansive mode than the real things. Many people contributed to all the solutions to the problems we had. In the movie, of course, we see Ken Mannelly doing a lot of the work because he was really a composite character in certain aspects of a lot of people that were doing work, feeding in information so that we could get the reentry program down pat and everything else. And that is the artistic license without taking away from the real meaning of the movie or the purpose of it or the ending, which, of course, fortunately, was very, very good.